Well, we begin just an informational piece, if it might be helpful for you, if you're at all interested in reading more on some of these themes and some of the early teachings. There's a wonderful reading list on bodhiinstitute.org, B-O-D-H-I. I had put out a leaflet about it over there, if someone has kind of reading it, if you could leave it behind, because it's the only leaflet I have with me. This is not a sales pitch, by the way. This is a new institute we've started in England, which is for the study of the early texts, but it has a really wonderful reading list on it. Okay, so we're moving on a little bit in this sutta. The Buddha offered what we covered this morning in about 9 sentences. But the last of those sentences, the Buddha makes a statement that here these unwholesome states cease without remainder. The way that I read this, although I'm not in agreement with all my colleagues, some but not all, the way that I read this is ceasing without remainder is essentially what it is saying, what is said in many other texts, including the Satipatthana Sutta, that this is a direct path to the unshakable liberation of the heart. And the Buddha puts forward this promise that there is a way of abiding in this world, where these anusyas we've talking about, these underlying tendencies, they're no longer just hiding there in the background anymore, waiting to be triggered and waiting to be reenacted. But they cease without remainder. They are gone. They are gone. It's essentially what he is saying. So after delivering this teaching in about 4 sentences, the Buddha got up. Remember, we're going to contextualize this again. The Buddha got up and went to his dwelling. Then, right after he'd gone, the bhikkhus, you can just visualize this, the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis looked at each other and said, "Did you get it?" They sort of scratched their heads and looked at each other. Did you actually understand what he was talking about? And they didn't. He says, there he's gone, without giving any detailed explanation of all of this. And then they thought, well, who can we ask? And then they said to each other, well, over there is the Venerable Mahakachana, one of the Buddha's chief disciples. He's really praised by the Buddha and esteemed by everybody else. He probably got it. So we'll go and ask him. So off they go to Mahakachana, and they catch him and exchange greetings, and then they sit down and they say, you know, could you please tell us what he was talking about? And of course this initiates a huge scolding. You know, Mahakachana says to them, friends, it's though a person needing heartwood, seeking heartwood, wandering in search of heartwood, thought that heartwood should be found amongst the branches and the leaves of a great tree standing possessed of heartwood after he'd already passed over the root. And so it is with you. He didn't go on to say you're sort of dummies. He says, so it is with you, that I should be asked the meaning of this after you were sitting in front of the Buddha, face to face with him, and that's the time when you should have asked the meaning of this, and after he told you, you should have remembered it. But then they kind of beg him a bit, and they said, we know, we should have asked the Buddha, you know, and we should have remembered it, but we didn't. So please, please, would you explain all of this to us in some meaning? So he agrees. You have to paraphrase these things, you know, a little bit. You know. So he agrees. So he says, then listen. He says, then listen, friends, to what I shall say. Yes, 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 by this point, they're willing to agree to anything. So, he goes back to the original statement. Bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, as to the source through which perceptions and notions tinged by mental proliferation beset a person, if nothing there is found to delight in, welcome, and hold to, this is the end of the underlying tendencies. This is the end of resorting to violence and to argument and to discord. These unwholesome state cease without remainder. So then, here he goes into this list, okay? So this list is tracing another way of tracing the cognitive chain that we were speaking about this morning. So he says, dependent on the eye and forms, eye consciousness arises. The meeting of these three is contact. Many of you will be familiar with this. This is not news to you. With contact as condition, there is feeling. What one feels, that one perceives. What one perceives, that is what we think about. What we think about, we mentally proliferate about. With what one has mentally proliferated as a source, perceptions and notions tinged by mental proliferation beset a person with respect to past, future, and present forms. This is really an important chain to consider, because this is what is happening moment to moment in our experience. The Buddha once said that on contact the world arises, and with the cessation of contact there is the cessation of the world. And the foolish pursue contact, and the wise seek to understand it. So with contact the world arises, and when we say with the world arises, again remembering we're saying that the world of experience arises. My world of experiences arise. So eye, sight, seeing. Ear, sound, hearing. Body, sensation, sensing. Tongue, taste, tasting. What have I missed out? Nose, smell, odor, smelling, mind, thought, thinking. Remembering in this world of the sense doors in Buddhist psychology, the mind is included as being the sixth sense door. So this is the beginning of it all, these moments of contact. With contact, the world arises. What arises has a feeling tone, and we touched on this morning. The pleasant, the unpleasant, and it is sometimes said that which is neither pleasant nor unpleasant, but I'm not convinced of that third category at all, because I think that which is neither unpleasant or pleasant is actually just that which we haven't paid attention to. And there's much in this room that we would say is neither pleasant nor unpleasant, but the moment we really attend to it, it doesn't stay that way. Okay? So feeling tone, this Vedana tone of experience. The Buddha once said that Vedana is the Pali word for this feeling tone, hedonic tone of experience. He said that Vedana rules consciousness. Vedana rules consciousness. Vedana is the king, the queen of consciousness. Because Vedana, this feeling tone, is one of the primary building blocks of our world beginning to take shape. So Vedana in itself, so Vedana, this feeling tone here, and this is going now to draw on several different sources to make sense of that feeling tone. Vedana goes to the underlying tendencies of craving, aversion, and delusion. That's where it goes to. Vedana is drawing on perception, how we have felt something in the past, how we make sense of that. Oh, that smell, I know it, you know? That taste, I know it. That sight, I know it. But we contact, we feel, what we feel, we perceive. So perception is coming here to actually, perception is a sign maker. Perception gives a name to things. It gives a sign to things. It's sometimes called a nimitta. Perception is now starting to make sense or cognitive sense of what has been happening very, very quickly of contact feeling. Perception will come in and it will give a name to it, it will give a label to it, it will give a sign to it. Now that perception, of course, is not innocent. Perception never comes to the party alone. Perception is coming to the party with all its memory friends. How I have perceived something in the past, how I associate that present moment experience with how I've experienced it in the past. So perception is traveling down exactly the same neural pathway as memory. So perception is making sense of the present through how we have made sense of it in the past. Okay. So that's our recognition factor. You know that deja vu feeling? It's constant in our life. You know, yes, I've been here before. Of course I've been here before. You know, I'm bringing that memory, bringing the past, actually by drawing on that memory system. Perception is bringing not only the actual memory, it is bringing the emotional memory into the present. Whether I liked that in the past, whether I disliked it, whether I feared it, whether I found it attractive, whether I found it unattractive. So by labeling, by sign-making, by trying to make sense of the world, perception is already being distorted. It's being distorted, and the distortion then is repeating. The distortion is repeating. So what we perceive, we proliferate about, we think about. Oh yeah, I remember it, yeah. That's how it is, you know, and oh, that's why I like this, and that's why I don't like this. We think about, we begin to proliferate about, and the proliferation is carrying all of those threads of proliferation that we talked about this morning. The threads of views, the threads of craving, the threads of aversion, the threads of anxiety. That is kind of threading, lacing through the proliferation. And then it goes on to say, when all of our perceptions and notions are tinged by mental proliferation, they beset a person with respect to past, present, and future. So the past is frozen into a particular framework which feels unchangeable. The past is brought into the present and actually is repeated. So it's actually past and present. There's no line between them. It is one that is floating through to be superimposed upon what is being experienced in this moment, and this is actually going to afflict future moments unless this process is interrupted or unless we have some new information which helps us to change our mind. The person walks through the door who irritated me 10 years ago. By seeing them through that distorted perception, I not only see the person, I actually bring forward that 10-year-old irritation right into this moment and go through it again. That person could disappear for another 10 years, and the next time I see them, there is that miserable person. They're still around and they're still miserable. Now what on earth is going to change that? Except, you know, that person is not going to have to, I mean, it may be that that person changes it for me. They may come and do something, offer me something in some incredibly generous way, you know, and I've got some new information that says, oh, maybe not, they're not entirely miserable. But we can't wait for people to change our minds all the time. You know, there's a little bit up to us here. And this is where the whole element of investigation, of slowing down, of beginning to question our distortions comes into being. This, we begin to understand that the only thing that keeps anything at all fixed in place in this life is our view of it. The only thing that keeps another person fixed in place, being a certain kind of person, is our view of them. The only thing that actually keeps this table fixed in place as a solid object is my view of it that makes it a table. The only thing that keeps me fixed in place in a certain way is the view and the clinging to the view that says, I am. I am. Is that all perfectly clear? There is a few lines from the Atacavaga, which is a very early text, and the Buddha says the sage should completely stop the thought I am, which is the root of naming associated with proliferation. He goes on to say sanyas, perceptions, distorted perceptions, do not lie latent in the noble one who dwells detached from sensual craving. The one who is detached from sanya, distorted perception, has no ties. One who is liberated through understanding has no illusions. Those who have grasped sanya, distorted perception, and view ditti, wander clashing in this world. Wander clashing in this world. What is happening here? Okay, I mean, again, I'm encouraging you to personalize this a little bit. What is also happening here, as we mentioned this morning, is the process of self-making. None of this is free from self-making. These are the building blocks of self-making. It is not, and when we speak about self-making, one shouldn't actually just really think about that as the I am. It is the way that self is being posited into objects and events and experiences through distorted perception. Basically, in that process of doing that, we're saying, this has the power to make me happy, that has the power to make me unhappy. That is intrinsically beautiful, that is intrinsically ugly. Therefore, we have the base and the foundation for craving and aversion. Without self-making in objects, without positing a self into objects, events, and experiences, there is no base for craving and aversion and all of that agitation to operate. Is that, do you understand, does that, you see that? So we begin to trace the source of this struggle. We begin to trace the source of this discord. And the kind of light dawns on us. It may be that none of this is predetermined. None of this is inevitable. None of us are kind of fated to go through this over and over again for the rest of our lives. We learn how to change the cognitive chain. We learn how to change the cognitive chain. It's a good pause moment. Anybody have anything? Yes, please.
We learn how to, we're not fated, etc. Practice.
So, I mean, the question is about, you know, if someone is not a practitioner, or even if someone is a practitioner. You know, some of this, although you hear me saying this is not a life sentence, sometimes it feels that way. And how do we actually make that change with patterns that seem so historical? It's like they were there when we were born, you know, and we just keep repeating them. I mean, of course, there are many, many ingredients in making those changes. I mean, we talked a little bit about this yesterday. I mean, first of it is a genuine willingness to be changed. You know, and that is not always an attractive prospect for people, because even when my present moment experience may be quite dire and difficult, it's familiar. And if I was to really change in reality, I might have to change the whole of my life. You know, I might have to change how I live. I might have to change how I relate to people, you know. So willingness is a huge, huge factor. Developing capacity is a huge factor. And this is, of course, where mindfulness does come in, because mindfulness develops our capacity. It develops resilience. It develops muscle in our capacity to explore and be with the difficult. But the biggest shift that I see anyone make in formal practice, in you know, more traditional settings, but also I do a lot of training of, or I'm part of the training of many, many mindfulness teachers, and the biggest shift that I see anyone make actually is the shift from aversion to befriending. And I don't see that anything changes at all without that shift. You know, and aversion, that chronic pattern to condemn, to push away, to not want to be with, to not want to be close to, is the primary barrier to understanding. Whether it's understanding another, whether it's understanding ourselves, whether it's making changes. And the biggest shift that I ever see anybody ever, ever make is from aversion to befriending. Well, that's part of befriending, an affectionate curiosity. An affectionate curiosity, it's sometimes described as. But that attitudinal shift is critical, it's pivotal. Because if we see the tendency of aversion, the impulse of aversion is to turn away from. If we look at the impulse of mindfulness and kindness, is to turn towards. That is the biggest shift. Without that, nothing ever can, in my understanding, nothing can change, because we don't have anything. We don't have understanding from a distance. We don't have compassion from a distance. We don't have investigation from a distance. It all requires intimacy. And that is a huge ask for many people, you know, not just people in therapy, but for many people, it's the biggest ask, is to be intimate with the difficult without being overwhelmed. And in a way, that is the training. You know, it's certainly the training that we all engage in. And, you know, for many people in therapeutic modalities, that is the training they engage in. You know, the willingness to keep turning towards rather than turning away. So that, for me, is the most pivotal piece. Yeah. Yes, please.
Can you elaborate on what I understood you say, contact? You said the foolish seek it.
The foolish seek to pursue contact, and the wise seek to understand it. Because this is the moment where our world begins to, just in a very embryonic way, pre-formation abiding. This is the way our world begins to emerge, in a very embryonic way. We've got the raw material, we might say. You know, we've got the raw material of the sense data, we've got the sensory door, and we've got the sensing. This is a kind of raw material, it's a very embryonic shape. Now, when we say the foolish seek to pursue contact, we just want more sights, more sounds, more smells, more tastes, more touch, more thoughts, more sensation, more. You know, we're constantly trying to make a world happen, you know, rather than to understand what is actually going on in this embryonic state, and understanding this is the beginning of our world of experience.
To the feeling part of lightening up, which is being moved.
We don't have any choice about contact, okay? It's very important. We don't have any choice about contact. As long as we live, there will be contact. This is just simply part of being an alive and a sentient human being. Contact is ethically neutral in itself, but it is often driven. See, that, and that's the part about the foolish pursuing contact. And think about this in just a very, very practical way. I mean, you know, when we used to have the retreats at Bastia, you know, Bastia, like most universities, and much less here, but, you know, kind of all the walls are papered, you know, with information, you know. And I remember someone coming to me after a walking period and saying, you know, I've read every job description there is for jobs I'm never going to apply for. I know about every apartment to rent I'm never going to move to. You know, I've read every housekeeping manual. And it's just that hunger, isn't it? It's the hunger to be stimulated. It's for a person who doesn't know inner wakefulness. Wakefulness is stimulated by contact. You know, so it's backed by that craving to become. It's backed by that craving to be the kind of person who has a certain kind of experience. And I'm sure many of you can relate to this and say the walking practice is really such a classic example. You know, I refer to it as floating head syndrome. You know, the body's going up and down the walking path. So that hunger you can feel, you know, is how the Buddha described, you know, that the world is on fire with this hunger. You know, this hunger for stimulation, you know, this hunger to be somehow fed a sense of aliveness through the sense doors. And that is when contact is no longer ethically neutral. In itself, it is ethically neutral. But contact is often driven by craving. And this is why the Buddha makes such a big deal about the craving for sensual pleasure. You know, because it's much more than just a craving to feel good. It's a craving that my aliveness depends upon this drip feed of stimulation. Constantly through the sense doors. And so, sometimes people get the impression the Buddha's a downer on pleasure, you know. I don't think he was a downer on pleasure, you know, but he was a downer on this hunger, this insatiable hunger, you know, that actually is so undermining of well-being and carries such a huge ideology underneath it that, you know, it is the satisfaction of that hunger that sustains me and makes me feel alive and awake. It's a paltry wakefulness. And it's a paltry aliveness that is dependent upon non-stop moments of contact. And doesn't it make us agitated and exhausted? Doesn't it just make us agitated and exhausted? So contact will happen. It's very, very important to understand this. Contact will happen as long as we are alive. Vedana will be part of our experience as long as we are sentient human beings. You know? There will be feeling tone in every single sensory impression. As we talked about this morning, a very small amount of that is actually objective. But it doesn't matter whether it's subjective or objective, there is feeling tone in every single sensory moment. In every impression of a sound, a sight, a taste, a touch. And we're not going to turn the tap off on that, and we don't have to. We're not trying to homogenize experience into some sort of bland neutrality. You know, that is not the object. The object is to begin to investigate. It's why the Buddha says Vedana rules consciousness, to begin to investigate what is it that makes something pleasant, what is it that makes something unpleasant, how much is distorted perception involved in this, how much is aversion and craving already implicated through distorted perception in how we experience something. And how we experience something. So this, you know, certainly, as many of you know, in the teaching of dependent origination, which is another model of how our world arises, feeling is the weakest link. Vedana is the weakest link in the process of world construction. If we can be truly mindful, at the point of those feeding tones, there is a possibility our perceptions will not be distorted. There is a possibility that our perceptions will actually simply be navigational perception of knowing something, rather than knowing something in relationship to the sense of I, of how I need it or want it to be, or have seen it to be in the past. So,
I have a quick question on the willingness to turn.
The willingness to turn to war, yeah.
Can you elaborate a little bit on that, as far as like turning towards, and then that whole spin cycle can happen with our thoughts on that? So,
the willingness to turn towards is not an, it's not, I mean, if you know how everybody struggles to have the right definition of mindfulness? You know, and everybody's always got a new definition of mindfulness. I've got a working model. And it's the willingness and capacity to turn towards all events and experiences equally with curiosity, kindness, and discernment. So it's not just the willingness to turn towards, but with kindness, curiosity, and discernment. And that's what's going to interrupt that turning towards and just being overwhelmed. So it's a very particular way of turning towards. You know, there's very little value for anybody in this life just to turn towards and be swamped. You know, they need to be resourced in that by kindness, curiosity, and discernment. And discernment very much draws into what we were talking about yesterday of not right and wrong and good and bad, but, you know, does this lead to suffering or does it lead to the end of suffering? Yeah? Does this lead to affliction? Does it lead to the end of affliction? You know, so mindfulness always has that in my mind, that those kind of qualitative aspects to it. Yes.
I'm thinking in very.
So the question again is touching upon what many of you have already mentioned, you know, of how quickly this all happens. You know, and that often we have almost retrospective awareness of, you know, there was a process that happened there. And it's almost as if the suffering is waking us up to actually try and learn something from that process, which is good, which is great. I mean, clearly the intention or the direction of the practice, I think, is to come more and more, closer and closer to the point of birth, the point of this all beginning. But we start where we are. You know, we always start where we are. And sometimes it is retrospective. And it's still to be honored that we really do want to learn something from having ended up in that place of conflict or struggle. We still want to learn something about how that happened. So even in that retrospective awareness, you are still beginning to build up the vocabulary and the literacy about the process. In a non-judgmental way, you know. We're still beginning to build up that literacy about the process. And in a sense, that's wonderful. That's a necessary ingredient. There's other parts that are important, you know, because people do not have the option in the midst of a sort of, you know, bombardment of events and experiences to say, I think I'll just go find my cushion for, you know, 20 minutes, just sit down and kind of slow this all down. That's not an option for many people, you know. People live in a world where there is bombardment, you know, not only outwardly, but often inwardly too. So, you know, that commitment to slowing it down, I think, has many aspects, you know. It's not just about sitting more. It's about developing literacy. It is about cultivating more stillness in the midst of agitation. The body is a great ally in this, you know. Even in the midst of this seeming earthquake of emotion, what in the body is still? What in the body can you connect with? Guarding the sense doors is important in my mind, you know. And I think we don't take that seriously enough. I think in the kind of the wildness of our world, you know, where there's so many sensory impressions, you know. I think people here guarding the sense doors as some sort of defensive motion, but it's actually part of protective awareness, you know. It's we're over, sometimes overexposed, You know, simply overexposed. And some of that we have no choice about, and some of that about that we may actually be pursuing the overexposure for the stimulation of it. You know, and if I give go back to that example I used earlier of being in the university, you know, like I could actually find a way of walking down that hallway without reading every notice, you know, without reading every handbook, without reading every printout. That actually I can do. That's well within, and that is what I mean by guarding the sense doors. I'm kind of pulling in a little bit from being so hooked by every passing sense impression that doesn't actually need my attention. You know, there are plenty that do need my attention, you know. It's good to have that when I'm driving my car, you know. I mean, it's good to have my sense doors all operating when I'm driving my car, you know. There's so many situations in my life where I just don't need to be all over the place. I just don't need to be so, either so hungry or so uncollected, you know. And I sort of think of it as, you know, have you ever been to IKEA? I mean, I have whole teaching stories about IKEA, but anybody who ever has never been to IKEA, you know, IKEA is an international way of getting lost. You know, but there's a plan to IKEA. You go in the front door and you follow the line. You follow the line. And if you follow the line, you get out. And if you don't follow the line, you can visit housewares 30 times, you know. And that's what I mean about guarding the sense doors. You know, you've got to keep your eye on what's needed, really on what's needed, you know. When I took my son to IKEA, I said, there's three things we need to remember: focused, fearless, and stick to the list. And if we do that, we're safe. It's a good working principle for life. Focused, fearless, stick to what's needed. But guarding the sense doors is important. You know, we I think often, you know, in our times of greatest hunger or discontent, this is when our sense doors get most busy. And this is where our sense doors could well be served by being far more collected and calm. You know, so, and that helps to slow down this process, you know, simply turning the tap down a bit, you know, of what is actually coming in. You know, but so it's not a one-dimensional approach, that's what I'm saying. It's not a one-dimensional approach to actually beginning to get closer to the beginning of all of this. We have a lot of skillful means, you know, and the willingness. And it's mostly about the willingness to step out of that wheel of suffering and pain. You know, it's not about being a good meditator. It's not about, you know, some task to do. It's that genuine, and we talked about this yesterday, this resoluteness and enthusiasm and ardency to bring suffering and struggle to an end. And we need that, you know. If we're lukewarm, our outcomes are lukewarm too, basically.
But we have to differentiate between aversion and keeping not to be come into contact.
Yes, of course we always have to distinguish between aversion and guarding the sense doors, you know. But that can be a little bit of a hook for us. I have to say that, you know, this can be a little bit of a, for some people, you know, I need to be so open because everything else is aversion. Well, actually, sometimes being so open is aversion, you know, because I don't want to be so close to myself, you know, so I would actually rather be flooded by sensory impressions than feel what I'm feeling, you know, that I have aversion to. I mean, guarding of the sense doors is a very intentional way of being in this world. It's a commitment to collectedness. You know, it's a commitment to a calm abiding. You know, and there's not necessarily, I mean, of course we can close down out of aversion, but aversion has quite a tangible feel to it in my experience. You know, there's a tightness to it rather than an intentional way of being. Yeah. Yes, please, Reggie.
When you use the word or somatic, does that refer to the body? I'm not quite clear.
Yes. Yes. I mean, a colleague of mine has this wonderful metaphor for, you know, the four ways of establishing mindfulness of body, feeling, mind, and process and phenomena. And he says, you think about it like there's four channels that are being broadcast all at the same time. There's the somatic experience, which is the body. There's the hedonic experience, which is the feeling tone. There is the affective experience, which is the mind states and moods. And there's a cognitive experience, which is on channel four. You know? So actually, we're deciding which channel, one, two, three, four, is actually useful for us to actually focus on. They're all being broadcast at the same time, but we highlight one channel by how we tune in. Hmm? Yeah. I don't have any magical answers to that, you know, because I don't think it matters what situation that's in. You put human beings together and you have clashes of views, you know, and you have clinging to one view or clinging to another view, and it could be in any context. You know, it could be in the context of a family, of a friendship, of a larger group. And I think what the Buddha is speaking about here is a change, not only within our own minds, but within our relational way of being in this world. Remember how this discourse started. This is the end of argument. This is the end of argument. This is the end, bringing argument and violence and conflict and enmity to an end, you know. And the only way we bring that to an end is actually by being aware of where we take that with us in our life, into any situation, and how we can bring it to an end in itself. I mean, you notice in the beginning of this sutta, when, you know, the fellow comes along and is a bit hostile with his stick, the Buddha doesn't try to actually change his mind and say, you know, you need to agree with me. He just actually says, this is what I see, you know. And that fellow walks away wagging his tongue, apparently, you know, and furrowing his brow. But there's no, hey, come on back, you know, you have to see it the way I see it, you know. There's no endeavor, but he says to him, friend. Even as the man is standing over him holding a stick, he says, friend, I've given up argument. I have given up quarrel. That's a big commitment in our life, that I've given up quarrel. And this is how I've come to understand for myself the way to give up quarrel. But unless we give up the quarrel, we haven't got a way forward relationally. Okay, so we're shortly going to get into the answer. Which actually, probably, it might not be quite as... Well, anyway, see what you make of it. I think we'll go into it in some detail after we have a break. But, okay, here it goes. When there is no I, no form, and no I consciousness, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of contact. When there is no manifestation of contact, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of feeling. When there is no manifestation of feeling, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of perception. When there is no manifestation of perception, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of thinking. When there is no manifestation of thinking, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of being beset by perceptions and notions tinged by mental proliferation. When there is no ear, no sound, and no ear consciousness, when there is no nose, no odor, and no nose consciousness, when there is no tongue, no flavor, and no tongue consciousness, when there is no body, no sensation, and no body consciousness, when there is no mind, no mind object, and no mind consciousness, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of being beset by perceptions and notions tinged by mental proliferation. The Buddha here is not speaking about being dead. He is speaking about a way of living. So I'd like you just to maybe reflect on that.